You can just tell it to record. Like normally here it would say it's full and stuff.
Yeah, okay.
So that's probably the easiest way. When you push it in, it'll read it and say, do you want to select the card? That's what it just said. And then just say yes.
Okay.
So nice. Rather than mess around with the folder.
Okay, thanks.
Serviceful, thou art bliss. To thy yogi, thou art bliss. O God, beautiful, O God, beautiful. O God, beautiful, O God, beautiful. At thy feet, oh, I do bow. At thy feet, oh, I do bow. O God, beautiful, O God, beautiful. In the forest, thou art green. In the forest, thou art green. In the mountains, thou art high. In the mountains, thou art high. In the river, thou art restless. In the river, thou art restless. In thy ocean, gray. In thy ocean thou art gray. O God beautiful, O God beautiful. O God beautiful, O God beautiful. At thy feet, O I do bow. At thy feet, O I do bow. God beautiful, O the thoughtful, thou art service. To the serviceful, thou art service. To the lover, thou art love. To the lover, thou art love. To the sorrowful, thou art sympathy. To the sorrowful, thou art sympathy. To thy yogi, thou art bliss. To thy yogi, thou art bliss. O God beautiful, O God beautiful. O God beautiful, O God beautiful. At thy feet, O I do bow. At thy feet, O I do bow. O God beautiful, O God beautiful. Beautiful, O God beautiful. God beautiful, O God beautiful.
No dozing in Master's Church. Please pray with me, O Heavenly Father.
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Blessed Master.
Dearest Mother.
Dearest Mother.
Saints and sages of all religions.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
Free my life.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Amen. After our wonderful meditation and chanting yesterday, I put out a posting. Yogis have marked the summer solstice with special reverence for thousands of years. In our modern way of living, we oftentimes become indifferent to the subtle changes in nature, even immune to the change of seasons. The yogis with highly sensitive nervous systems mark these changes, feeling the powerful but refined shifts of vibration throughout the day, seasons, years, and even millennial flux. Yesterday, we gathered in deepened meditation and chanting to avail ourselves of the thinning of the veil of separation that occurs during the solstice. Spiritual skies with blue vault above and a brilliant light shining everywhere but with no center revealed itself and made heavenly consciousness an easy reach. Powerful cosmic rays from divine consciousness easily flowed from celestial regions. All felt the uplifting forces that purify the whole self. Today we gather again in these uplifting currents, continue to let eagle heart soar. Join in this dance of the seasons and let joy surge through you as a mighty river and peace pervade you as an immense sea. In reading from the Vision magazine, June of 2014, Papa writing on peace. Your search is for peace. Peace is an internal state of soul acquired through the realization of the highest truth, which is inherent in every human being. Peace relates to the eternal. The transient and the ephemeral things of the world are incapable of granting peace. If you would have peace, turn your mind to the immortal source of your life, the deathless, changeless reality. By constant contemplation and meditation, tune your thought to this reality. Ultimately, sublimate it into the divine existence and thereby attain to a peace which knows no change. God is peace. Truth is peace. So be the devotee of God if you long for peace. Live and act for the sake of this peace and having possessed it, spread its cooling radiance around, bathing all about you in its blissful floods. First, gain the peace of God within yourself. Be liberated from the clutches of a restless spirit which has thrown the soul into darkness and chaos. Raise every thought and emotion towards the supreme seat of light, power, and peace. Enter into the deepest realms of utter silence and repose of the Godhead. Associate in all manner of ways with this transcendent, all-pervading, and static being of the Godhead. By entire dedication, be one with Him. Soar up with the wings of burning aspiration to the immortal throne of peace, and find there the tranquility and calmness for which you have struggled so far. Nowhere else can you attain it, for nowhere else does it exist. O lovers of peace, everlasting peace is your birthright. The kingdom of peace is within you. Nay, you are the very mold and expression of that immutable truth. Seek not outside of this greatest consummation of life. Taste the nectar of peace in the recesses of your being. There resides the heavenly light that lends splendor and beauty to all things. Fill your heart with the pure emotions of love and compassion. Illumine your intellect with the light of eternal wisdom. Surcharge your actions with the spirit of spontaneous service and sacrifice. Then only the divine peace that passeth all understanding will be yours unto eternity. You will then be the very embodiment of absolute peace. Your life will shine like the full moon in a cloudless sky. You will reach the sublimest acme of life's attainment. Many times we think of peace as an outer state. There is no war, there's no violence, there's no one who's upset with another. It's peaceful. But the peace that Papa refers here, this peace of God is something that is really superlative. It is a tangible essence that you can experience within yourself and everywhere about you. This feeling of peace pervades the entire creation. And because we have not the eyes to see it nor the ears to hear it, we don't feel it, we don't experience it, and it is a great, great loss to experience this level of peace, to be immersed in it and have it immersed in you is the greatest thing that you can attain to. It really is. And so do not think of it as something that is distant and far from you, but rather something that is close and attainable. Reading from this latest Cross and Lotus Journal, Memories of Mother, and this is a letter that Mother sent to devotees in 1957 from India. And she writes, "How time flies. It doesn't seem possible that so much of it has elapsed since our last letter to you. But in this seemingly timeless land, that is not surprising. We go to bed each night thinking that surely tomorrow we will find some time to do some writing, and believe me, our intentions are the best. However, when another day rolls around, we find to our dismay that it has been packed to the hilt with new and wonderful experiences. But the sheets of paper we had laid out preparatory to sharing these experiences with you still remains in their virgin state. I wish it were possible to put down everything as it happens, only because in that way can one capture in its entirety the mood, the picture, the event, and the impression formed as it makes its first impact upon the mind and senses. I wish, too, I had the artistry of words with which to paint in true and glowing colors the picture of life in India as it passes before our eyes. Better still, I wish that you were here with us so that you might share our wonderful adventure. I thought that rather than continue our travel log where I left off, it might be interesting to describe a chapter out of our life here while it is still fresh in my mind. I shall pick up the threads of the journey from America later on. This time I'd like to tell you about our recent trip to Madras. We had planned previously to go on a tour of India during the months of January and February because we had been told that these were the two best months of the year for travel. However, as the time drew near, neither of us felt in the mood. Finally, we laid our problem in Papa's lap, and he said, "Well, to tell you the truth, Ram Dass is not much for it." To those who are not familiar with this habit of referring to himself in the third person, his manner of speech will no doubt seem very strange. But because the ego consciousness is entirely absent, having been absorbed completely in God consciousness, it is literally impossible for him to say the word "I" in connection with himself. That settled it. He did agree, however, with Father's suggestion that it might be a nice change if we visit Madras just for a week or so. There are some very famous and historical places in and near there which no traveler to India should miss visiting, particularly if his interest is in the spiritual field. So we readily compromised on Madras instead of a continental tour and immediately felt much relieved over our decision. We decided to leave on December 28th, immediately after Papa's Sannyas Day, which is December 27th. Sannyas Day is the day that he took sannyas, and they celebrate it every year at the ashram. The anniversary of the day he took his vow to renounce all things of the world and dedicate himself completely to God. But because of the heavy traffic during the holiday season, we were unable to get reservations in a first-class compartment until January 2nd. Papa emphasized constantly that God does everything for the best. So, having put ourselves in His hands, we have come to accept everything that happens, whether it is apparently good or bad, in that light. He illustrates almost everything he says through the telling of stories, and in this case is no exception. To drive home the point, he told us a story about a parrot. It seems a man went into a pet store to buy a parrot. There were quite a few birds there, but one in particular attracted his attention. He went over to the bird, examined it thoroughly, and said to the shopkeeper, "This seems to be a very nice parrot." The parrot cocked its head to one side, looked at him, and said, "There can be no doubt about it." The man was immediately intrigued with the parrot's intelligent answer, so the purchase was made. He took the bird home, anticipating that it would derive a great deal of pleasure in conversing with it. But, much to his disappointment and chagrin, the only thing the parrot could ever say was, "There can be no doubt about it." The constant repetition of the same sentence finally inflamed the man's anger to such an extent that he waved his fist at the parrot and shouted, I was certainly a darn fool to ever have bought you." The parrot looked at him, blinked its eyes, and said in a deep, throaty voice, "There can be no doubt about it." So now, whenever anything occurs which causes Papa to say, "God does everything for the best," somebody pipes up, "There can be no doubt about it," and we all have a good laugh. To be continued. Larry had steered me towards a book about Neem Karoli Baba, tremendous master in India. I had not read much about him other than some of the exploits of Richard Alpert, known as Ram Dass here in America. And so these have been fascinating books. They were written by a man who was a university professor, who was somewhere between agnostic and atheistic in his beliefs and was a communist in his political views. And this guru, Neem Karoli Baba, as you'll see, is a very unusual character. And so I thought I'd read you from his book here. The author's name is Dada, which is a name that Neem Karoli Baba gave him, which is older brother, which is an interesting thing for the guru to say about a disciple. "We are not following the guru. The guru actually is following us. I say this because I found it in my own life, my own personal experience, and I have seen it in the case of others too. Babaji came to me himself, unsought, unknown. I had no need, no desire, no idea, but still he forced his mantra onto me. I came from a village in Bengal, which is now part of Bangladesh. We belonged to the landed property class, and the income from our property was sufficient for the maintenance of the family, but there was not much coming from it. We had, in the India of those days, the joint family system. Father, mother, grandfather, grandmother, uncle, aunt, children, all living together, a very big family. I was a small boy in that village in 1928, and I had the sacred thread ceremony. Just a few months after that, my father died. I had finished my village school education, and the question was where I was to go to school for further study. Had my father been alive, we would have moved to some town or city where he could have earned money for this purpose. But now that was not possible. So I ascended to Allahabad, to the home of a maternal uncle, and the joint family system providing help and support. I read for exams there, and after high school, my uncle wanted me to get a job and earn money rather than continue my education. My uncle was transferred to another city and went away, but I was able to continue to stay in Allahabad at his house. No financial help was coming from anybody. I knew that very well, but somehow or other, I knew that I must continue my studies. I took the only course open to a boy like that, which was to do private tutoring. Every morning and evening, I taught some children in their homes, earning just enough to manage. A number of years passed in this manner. In 1935, I had done my undergraduate examination and had a 2.5-month summer vacation. I went to my village near Calcutta, about 600 miles from Allahabad. On the way, I visited some relations in Calcutta who asked me to stay with them for some time. While staying there, I would purchase a tram ticket and move about the city the whole day at a time. One day, I went to Dakshineshwar. That's the temple grounds where Ramakrishna had lived out his life. He had passed by that time. I went to Dakshineshwar, as I sometimes visited temples. I had been there before. Not that I had any religious interest in temples, but it was a very pleasant place on the bank of the river. It was the month of May at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It was so very hot that a very few visitors were there, although a few sadhus of the ashram were moving here and there. On the bank of the river Ganges, there are rows of small Shiva temples, not very impressive, just lingams. Out of curiosity, I thought I should go and see every one of them. It's interesting how the mind works, doesn't it? He's atheistic, he has no interest in this. Where does he go for his leisure time? He goes to a temple. Oh, I'm just going to visit all of these Shiva temples. And he has no thought about it at all. Not that I was very interested, but I would be able to say that when I had seen them all, when I came out of the fifth or sixth temple, there was a certain gentleman standing there. He was a bulky sort of fellow, with a mustache and a small beard, and a dhoti tucked around his waist. He spoke to me in Hindi, "My son, you are a Brahmin. I shall give you a mantra." I said I would not take it. "No, no, I will give you a mantra." I said, "I have got no time for that. I do not believe in it." Actually, I was a non-believer in the sense that I was not doing any scriptures, any puja or prayer, and moreover, politically, I'd become sympathetic to communism, reading about socialism and revolution and all those things that were of interest to my young group of friends. However, in India, religion is so much part of life, the whole family tradition, the culture, the social life. I could call it superstition and be an atheist, but my mother, my grandmother, my nephew, my uncle, my neighbors are all part of the religion. All the celebrations and entertainments are in fact pujas, prayers, and dramas celebrating the lives of Krishna and Ram. So that you come to be affected by it, for good or for bad. As far as my mind or intellect was concerned, I was denying this effect. When this man said, "I must take a mantra," I said, "No, I have got no time for reciting your mantra." He said, "When you take your bath and recite the Gayatri mantra, you must do it then." I thought, this is very strange. How did he know that? When a Brahmin gets his sacred thread, that is the mantra he is given. It is said to be the most sacred mantra for the Brahmin. I did recite the Gayatri mantra, not because I understood the meaning or was interested in it, but simply because my father told me a Brahmin boy must not forget this mantra. Had my father been living, perhaps I might not have obeyed, but since he died soon afterwards, I did it. So how did this gentleman know this? It was certainly a very strange thing. In order to get rid of him, I said, "All right, tell me." Then he told me the mantra. I heard it. I walked away only a few steps when I looked back and there was nobody there. I began to wonder where he had come from. I knew it was not a dream or my imagination because I had seen him physically present and I remembered the mantra. The next day, I returned to my village. One day, when I was talking to my mother and auntie and grandmother, I told them what had happened in Dakshineshwar. They are very excited. "How lucky you are. You were in such a sacred place and at such a young age. You were given a mantra in Shiva's temple. It is so very difficult to get a guru, even in old age, and here you have gotten a guru. You are very lucky." That is, of course, what old people think, I said. Nothing, and the matter ended there. In the years that followed, I completed my university education, did some research work, and was appointed a teacher in the university. After that, my young brother, Subodh, my mother and my auntie came to Allahabad, and we were living in a family household. In 1950, Didi and I were married. She was teaching in a government college there. The month of June 1955 was one of the hottest months you could imagine. One Sunday evening, I was sitting talking with a number of friends in the open courtyard. About 9 o'clock at night, Didi Ma and Mashi Ma were going somewhere. I asked them, "Where are you going now?" They said that some Baba had come and was staying in a nearby house and they were going to see him. Before anybody could reply, one of my friends said, "What kind of Baba is he? Does he eat anything? I can feed him." He said it sarcastically. This friend had become a hunter, and he used to hunt deer and hare, which is what he was referring to. That shows something of our attitude towards the saints and sages at the time. Didi and my mother said, "You must not talk like that about a sadhu or saint. You must bear reverence for them in your heart." The women were gone only 20 minutes or so. The house they had gone to was right across the road. We inquired, "What's the matter? Didn't you meet him?" "We met him." They described the very small bedroom in the mud hut where the Baba, covered with a bedsheet, was sitting on an ordinary cot. The only light was a flickering candle. When they reached the small porch before that room, they looked at him and he said, "Jao, go." They had come with some expectations, so they weren't ready to go. He said it a second time, "Jao." Even then, they would not go. Then a third time, he just looked at his hand and said, "Kamala," that is his wife's name, "your husband's Bengali friends have come. Go and serve them tea. I shall come tomorrow morning." Gone was the lighthearted and loose talk about sadhus and their way of life. Everyone was wondering how he could know that we were sitting here and waiting for tea. How could he know Didi's name? And how could he know my Bengali friends were here? So it was rather a little mysterious for us. We did ask Didi how this meeting had come about. The girl in that house was a student of Didi's in her college. Didi is his name for his wife, who is otherwise known as Kamala. Student of Didi's in her college, she had mentioned that sometimes a Baba came to their house, which we had not known. That day, the girl had told Didi that the Baba, who was called Neem Karoli Baba, had come. Therefore, the women had gone there. My friends decided to return to their rooms in a distant part of the city and come again the next day. The next morning, I went with Didi to the house. I saw the Baba just lying on a cot with a bedsheet on. As soon as Didi and I came, he got up and caught hold of my hand, leaned on my shoulder, and started walking towards our house. He was walking so fast that Didi had to take off her slippers to run after us. Entering our house, he said, "Henceforth, I shall be living with you." Can you imagine? "Henceforth, I shall be living with you." It was a small house, only 2 bedrooms, and we were quite a big family. As soon as he came, he went and sat on a cot. Ma, Mushi Ma, and Didi came to the room, prostrated before him, and then went to prepare some milk and fruit. So I was alone with him. The first thing he asked me was, "You are a devotee of Shiva." I said, "No." He said, no, you go to the temple." Then he said, "You have your mantra also." I said, "Yes." But I could not correlate in any way that this was the same person that had given me the mantra at the Shiva temple some 20 years earlier. While we were talking, Ma, Moshi Ma, and Didi entered the room with some food for him. A glass of milk, some fruit cut into pieces, and some sweets. He took the milk and a few pieces of fruit. The rest he asked them to leave there. While they were talking, some visitors began coming. He had been coming to that house across the street for a number of years. We would see many cars and persons coming and going, but we did not know why. There had been no curiosity. I had not heard his name. Now some person started coming to our house to see him, and we found out he was actually a well-known saint in the area. A certain gentleman came, whom I knew very well. He entered the room. He looked around, and seeing some other persons there, he tried to go out. But before he could do so, Babaji asked him, "You take bribes?" The man began trembling. Babaji said, "Tell me, you take bribes?" He said, "Baba, in this service, everyone takes something." He was trembling in such a way I thought he was going to fall down, so I caught hold of him and made him sit. He is an excise inspector who had taken bribes and been suspended from his job. He had come to Babaji thinking that he might do something to get his job back. And the funny thing was is that the excise commissioner, Kahar Singh, the head of the department, was sitting right there in the room. And the man next in command to him, Sinha, was also there. I thought, what a strange thing this was. Here was the confession made before the biggest bosses. The man was given some prasad from a plate, asked to go away. After he had gone, Babaji talked to Kahar Singh. Soon afterward, the man was reinstated in his job. While talking with the people in the room, Maharaji Neem Karoli Baba suddenly got up and told Kahar Singh, "Chalo, let's go." We did not understand anything at all, where he was going, when he would come back, whether he would come back at all or not. None of those who were with him could help us in this matter. All they said was that nothing could be known about him. We came out of the house. Kahar Singh's car was at the door. While standing there, we saw the hunter friend come in a rickshaw. He was only a short distance away when Babaji got into the car. Mashima requested that Babaji not leave yet, but with no effect. The friend missed seeing him by a few minutes and said he would try again in the evening. A short while after this friend was gone, Babaji returned and stayed for the whole day. In the evening, when our friend came again, he learned that Babaji had just gone out. He tried for 4 days at different times, but always missed Baba. He tried several times afterwards, but to no avail. His wife and children used to come and have Babaji's darshan, but it was not to be for him. He gave up all hope of seeing Babaji. Years later, Mashima said, "Baba, I know my son has done something very unworthy, but he is very unhappy. Be gracious to him and give him darshan." "All right, Mashima, send for your son." He came that evening and Babaji gave him darshan. This was 6 years after he made the remark about feeding meat to a sadhu and was rebuked by Ma. During that first day, several persons came and Babaji talked to him. I was only a spectator with nothing in particular to do, but I was curious, how did he know things? In the afternoon, 3 friends came. 2 were doctors and 1 was an office employee. Babaji was lying on his cot, and when he saw these people coming in, he sat up, welcomed the first one, a doctor, and said, "You come in. He is a saint." The other doctor was told by Baba, "Go. Why have you come to me? Go and earn your money." The doctor went away annoyed and never came to Babaji again. Babaji took no notice of the third person. His second visit was after 3 months, and it was almost the same routine was followed. After his arrival, visitors would be coming. Often he would go out to his devotees' houses, and sometimes I was asked to accompany him. He would sit for a short while, partake a little of prasad offered to him, and distribute the rest. His talks were mostly about the household problems of devotees, and he would give suitable advice. There was no talk of God or spiritual matters unless somebody would ask for that. People loved him, served him in their humble way, and treated him like their own. And so the story continues to unfold. Only in India would a Baba show up and say, "Now this is my home." great spiritual masters have walked upon this earth, and they all bring the same message. They want for us to discover that hidden wealth within us that they have found within themselves. This quality of peace that Papa talked about is an equanimity that you find within yourself when you get established in that divine consciousness, for peace and God are one and the same thing. And as I said earlier, it is not just a state of nonviolence. It's not a nothing state. It's a very active, powerful state of being to be in. When you feel that peace and it's operating through you, it has a divine intelligence and consciousness about it. It lifts you into an entirely new sphere of consciousness, and one that you can participate in day or night. We see today that we live a life of relative ease, of many luxuries, of having so many conveniences, and yet we hear all the time how people live in anxiety and in fear. This sense of anxiety is something that has become pervasive, and it seems almost that the more luxuries we get, that the more anxiousness there is about it all. The more time savers are, the more pressed we feel for time. And it is because we have looked to this world, to the outside, in order to attain this peace. If everything is cool and smooth and calm all around me, if nobody gives me any trouble at all, then I can feel peaceful, is what we think. But this is putting the horse before the cart. We actually need to go deep inside of ourselves first. How do we go about doing that? How do we release the anxiousness, the fear that is always with us? I certainly have had it in my life. And it's something that is a dictator. It will drive you to distraction if you let it. So much of what we experience in terms of anxiousness and peace is simply a mindset. It is the way that we talk to ourselves. It is the way that we enter into this life, our attitude towards it, thinking about all the things that can go wrong, thinking about all the ways that people can abuse us or disappoint us, and we live in preparation for any such exigencies. But this is the wrong way to go. We can anticipate everything wrong, everything bad, and put ourselves into a total state. We are not any better prepared if anything happens that is difficult or disappointing, having done that, than if we have prepared ourselves by anchoring ourselves in the divine consciousness, trusting in God. Trust is something that is absolutely essential. And as Dada, the author of this book, gradually describes, Baba, without ever trying to convert him, just coming up every 3 months to his house, showing up for several days, having all of these people come, and listening to people tell their stories about Neem Karoli Baba, and gradually he's completely won over and becomes a tremendous devotee. But it didn't happen all in an instant, and he certainly had his times of anger and rage and frustration and fear. And so through these descriptions, he talks about how Babaji, as he calls Neem Karoli Baba, helps him to unwind all of those psychological cords, all of those things that have given him so much trouble. But when you experience any kind of anxiety over anything, recognize it for what it is. It is a projection into the future. And what you are projecting is some lack or limitation on your part that you won't be able to handle it, that you won't be able to adjust to whatever it is that life gives to you. When Papa Ramdas saw that their printing press and the building that it was in was going up in flames, he started to dance around in joy. And people looked at him and said, Papa, but that's the printing press. That's the building. It's all being destroyed. Papa said, isn't it beautiful? Isn't it wonderful? Don't you love to see the flames and the fire? They somehow didn't catch the spirit from Papa. They were more anxious about what was being lost. And Papa said that within a month, the building had been rebuilt even better than before, and they had a new printing press that was even better than the original one. And so it's just Ram's way of discarding something in order to make way for something new. We feel attached to things, and our greatest attachment is our idea to how life should go. We have this idea, it should all be smooth, it should all be easy, everything should go my way, and when it doesn't, we feel vastly disappointed by that. We constantly compare the idea that we're attached to about how this world should be, and comparing it with the reality that we find around us, and we find it wanting. And we are just as much saying that we're finding fault with God and how He is running His universe, and we don't like it. And people get angry about it, people get frustrated about it, people become afraid about it, and hang on to that without realizing they've done it to themselves. When we simply accept what God gives to us as His will, and that it is always meant for our highest good, then we can let go of the fear or the anxiety. I was once traveling up in the Himalayas, and there the roads are wide enough, sometimes for a car, sometimes for a car and a half. But you meet these large lorries, these trucks that are coming down the hill. You're going up the hill. The driver is edging off to the side as far as he can with hundreds of feet drop right below you. No side guards, no side rails at all. And you can literally just look over the edge and look straight down for hundreds of feet. The tire is just hugging right to the edge of that road. And if it just goes off a couple of inches, off you go, a vehicle and everyone in it. And so I looked at that and I thought, well, that's interesting. I wonder what would happen. And I just imagined it in my mind. And I just saw the Jeep going off and all the people with it. And then I thought to myself, well, if that's my end, if that's my last moment, how would I want to go out? And I thought, well, I would want to go out chanting God's name. So I just imagined myself hollering out, Hari Om, all the way down to the bottom of the ravine, having my mind fixed upon God. And if that was it, and it smashed down at the bottom, and that was lights out, life over, good enough. Good enough. And so then any anxiousness about that just left me. What is there to be anxious about, really? Even if everything is taken away from you, will God not provide for you? There's a wonderful story told in India about the man who lived in a small village. He had some sons, family. They had a hut. They had a nice, modest home and all the things that go with it. It seemed as though one thing after another was being taken away from him. And every time he would have something taken away, he would say, as God wills. Well, after a while, this started to really irritate his wife, who was not so thrilled with what God was willing, as he's taking away this, that, and the other thing. And they ended up with no firewood. They ended up, their dog was eaten by a lion, and all of their animals were gone, and they were really in tough, tough straits. But one of the Rajas, one of the rulers, came through the village one day, and he was collecting soldiers because there was a war coming, and he wanted to take all the young men. This man and his sons and family all stayed in the hut while they came, and they took away all of the young men, but they looked at this one particular hut. They saw there is no smoke coming out of the fireplace. They saw there is no dog outside that would bark and warn of anybody coming. For all the life of it, it looked completely deserted. And so they just passed right on by, and his sons were preserved, and all the other sons were taken off to war and perished. And so when this Raj had left the village, the man said, as God wills. Now his wife was more in favor of it. How difficult it is to have that kind of trust, to have that kind of faith, that whatever you have is perfect for you. This does not mean that you do not dream. You do not dream of more, of having something more, but you rest content in your present moment with what you have, because part of your present moment is the creative idea is of something more. And that's all right. You hold it as a causal creation, as a mental idea creation, and you let it percolate, and you see what God does with it. And he brings some more energy to it, and that's the, so you move from the causal into the astral, and you start getting excited about it. You start forming clear conceptions about what it is you would like to bring into being. And as you have tuned in to God from the beginning, and then that spawns the idea, and from the idea, the energy, and finally comes out the material creation. That is how God created this entire universe. And we are meant to be co-creators with God. But to feel disenchanted with our lives as they are today is really fixating your mind on what you don't like. And when you fixate your mind on that, you will create more of that. So you end up creating more of what you don't like. You have to, in a very positive sense, begin to think about what you want. If a mother is watching her child on the swing set, be careful, don't fall down, don't fall, don't fall, don't fall. The child has to imagine falling from the swing set before it can imagine knowing what not to do. And you practically guarantee that that child will fall. But if the idea is be strong, be coordinated, be careful, be mindful, are introduced, then those things are what gets created. So we have to look at our minds and how they tend to go. Anxiety is anticipating the worst and then living it out time after time after time. It is said that a coward dies 1,000 deaths, a hero dies but once. Because in our cowardly state, we fear and we run over the and anticipate all the different ways that we can die, that we can be hurt, and so on. And here, something God told me once comes in very pertinent. And that is that for any situation that you are put into, there is a sufficient, more than sufficient, amount of grace that comes to you in order to meet and surpass that experience. And so if you look at somebody's situation and you think, oh my gosh, I could never do that, I could never go through that, it is only because you are looking from the outside and you are not in that experience, so that grace is not actively flowing to you in that moment. But being in that situation yourself, being open to that grace, not being closed because of fear or anger about the situation, but being open to the grace comes in and it supports you in moving through that situation. Isn't that wonderful? It is a tremendous promise. And so you don't have to worry about your future. You don't have to worry about what may come. And when you think about the things that might happen that we would term to be a negative kind of thing, you instill yourself with that grace, you feel that power, you feel that strength, you feel that intelligence flowing to you in order to meet that situation. That's how you're programming your brain in order to move off into the future. And you think of yourself, all right, if that situation were to happen to me, and now I soften open along the spine, I feel that life energy, I feel that comfort, I feel that guiding intelligence all flowing to me in perfection. And I am perfectly sustained in that moment. I am perfectly sustained in that moment. The truth is, when we come to this end of this life, it feels as if this life has been over in a flash, so quickly. And I know that there are circumstances in their times that seem to stretch out in eternity in a negative kind of a way. But when once passed through them, they seem like a very short time indeed. When we have the perspective of the divine consciousness, when we accept what God brings to us, this Neem Karoli Baba, he shows up at this man's house, he's an atheist, he's a non-believer, he's not interested. But the guru pulls him in. This house is mine now. Later on, he tells him, this house is not big enough. You need a new house. Why is it not big enough? All these people are coming to see Baba. Baba, we have no money. Ah, money will come. And gradually, over time, property came, land came, everything came, the house was built. And somebody was saying, oh, how it was nice that Baba had built this home for Dada. He says, this is not Dada's house, this is my house. So it's only when we just look in the microcosm, too much we look just at the picture of what is today. We step back, we step into our divine selves. Know always that your divine self is with you. And when you step back and you look for that perspective and you see your whole life laid out before you, you look at the trends, you look at the things that plague you or have plagued you in the past. You look at those things that provide difficulties. And you know what? In any journey, at any time, it's oftentimes the times that we were paralyzed, almost paralyzed with fear, that we remember the best. Those times that we were really challenged, that were really difficult, those are the ones we tell stories about. If everything's just even and smooth and, oh, well, that's not presenting such a good story. So as I wrote about in the Master Forger, in the posting there, that for the most toughest, durable materials, they're put under the greatest amount of heat, the greatest amount of pressure in order to form those materials. And if you feel in your life that God has you in the crucible, he has you in the anvil and he's pounding away at you, just know that the greater the heat within that crucible, the harder the hits that come from that being caught in the anvil, that is the toughness of the material that you're being created into. And when you understand that, you have a lot more patience. You have a lot more understanding for what God is doing. And then you're able, through that acceptance, through that trust, through that love for God, those become elements of the alloy that has created this tremendous substance, which you become a God-man or a God-woman. You see how tremendous this is. And instead of grumbling and complaining and being fearful all the time, we instead use everything that comes to us as a prompter to bring in more grace, more strength, more clarity. We use the very same circumstances and it helps us to grow spiritually. Instead of retard our progress by giving in to a fear and just going with it and making very poor decisions as a result. You know, the person who's walking through the dark woods at night and suddenly they get scared. Maybe there's a noise or something that happens and they get very scared. Now they see a bush and it looks like a bear. They see a stick on the path and it looks like a snake. And they could start running out of panic and really harm themselves by falling into a ditch somewhere. And it's all needless. It's all a fabrication of the mind only. We do not need to fabricate difficulties. There's enough that find their way to our doors without any need for us to bring them into imagination. It's true, isn't it? Why do we bring so many to our door through our imagination? How many difficulties, how many problems do we rehearse in our minds time and time again? You think about it, if you had to give up and get up before a group of people and give a talk and say some words, and maybe you tremble with fear at the thought of it, but instead think of just tuning into God and letting God speak through you and flow through you. Feel that power flow through you. Just feel the wonderful essence of God creating through you. Any circumstance you can imagine, you begin to put in this essence of God, this grace that is flowing through you. And it will give you such a great feeling of peace. One of the things that realization of God gives you is the absence of fear. You may get startled by something, a large sound, and it startles the body. The body may react, but you don't live in that fear and anxiety ever again. You're free from it. And so you tune in to that degree of peace, that stability within your own being. And just think about being able to walk into any room, meet any person or any group of people anywhere in the world, and being completely at peace. You know who you are in God. You're satisfied with who you are in God. God is presenting you to this person or to these people or to this situation. And He's equally flowing as grace to you in order to meet that situation. And having total and complete confidence in that, like a baby being carried by the mother. And the baby just knows the mother is there. The mother is taking care of everything. The Divine Mother has you. But we're naughty children and we run away from the Divine Mother. And we don't accept her help. And this is our problem. So really investigate yourself and find those places that separate you and take you away from peace. And make it your job in life to establish yourself in that peace that surpasses all understanding. It is substantive. It is tangible, that peace. It is a quality that is so powerful, it will overwhelm your mind. That's how it surpasses all understanding. It's so terrific. It's so powerful. It's so great that your mind really cannot comprehend it. It can only surrender to it. And it is part of you. You may have lived with anxiety your entire life, but you do not need to end your life that way. Not at all. Not at all. You can have that peace now, and you can have it always. And now will you pray with me? O Heavenly Father. Divine Mother. I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Om. peace, bliss. Amen. Pranams, I bow to the great God within you. May that light of peace fill your temple and radiate out to all of this world. Imagine a world in which all mankind is attuning itself to that level of peace. Would this world not be a heaven on earth? So be it.